World War II, a time of unrelenting global trauma, stretching from 1939 to 1945. It involved all of the great powers of the time. It was the most destructive episode in the history of civilization. It required its major forces to dedicate their entire military, economic, industrial, and scientific capabilities to the cause of warfare. Estimates of the death toll vary, from 50 million to 85 million worldwide. World War II took the art of war to new and appalling heights through massacre, genocide, remorseless bombing raids, starvation, disease, and the first use of nuclear weapons. Delphi Gwynneth Graham had a French grandmother and loved speaking the language. When war broke out, she wanted to join the Free French Forces, but encountered strict parental opposition. Instead, the young Del Edwards, as she was then, had to settle for a nursing career through the Australian Army Medical Women's Service. The big question, your beautiful name, Delphi, D-E-L-P-H-I-E, what's the origin of that? Why did your parents call you that?
Well, I have no idea why, but when I asked once, I was told that she was walking through a cemetery, which they did in those days, and saw this little Delphi, somebody or other that had died, and she felt sorry for her, and she thought it was a pretty name, so she called me Delphi, and I've always absolutely hated it because I've spilt it every day of my life for 92 years. I'm 92 now.
It is a very pretty name, though, with wonderful Greek classical origins.
Yes, and actually, we went over to Greece one year, and we got a tour of us from
disembarked
yeah. from the plane, and got a bus up to Delphi, and it was up in the hills, and it was absolutely the most idyllic place I've ever seen. I loved it. And
so Delphi went to Delphi. Did you have some sort of wonderful feeling coming through the earth to you at that occasion?
No, I just thought, I'll say, this is where it all started. That's about it.
But for you, life started a long way from Greece. You were born in Murray Bridge,
yes.
9th December 1924.
That's right, that's correct. And yes, my father had come back from the war and picked up with my mother again, who used to play tennis together before he went to the war and ride their bikes there. And she was a bit naive, and she used to say to him, "Oh, you don't want to leave your old thing next to mine." I always remember them saying that. And they got together and got married. But unfortunately, a few years later, Dad had had the accident by then.
Let's come to your dad's accident in a minute. But back to the early days, he was a war veteran, World War One. He'd yeah. gone over the top. What did he tell you about that?
Well, he didn't tell me anything, but my Uncle Joe, who was his best mate, said at his funeral, he said, and I'll never forget it, he said, "My God," he said, "I'll never forget George." He said, in those days when we used to go over the top, he said, he'd say, "You stay back there, you've got a girlfriend, you've got a wife, you've got so-and-so." He said, "I've got no one." And he said he'd go over the top. And he did that all the time. And he did it so much in these terrible trenches that he got trench feet and was in several hospitals having the trench feet, treated. And so he's always suffered with one... He always suffered with one leg that was kind of completely pushed out of shape around the ankle, and that I felt so. I had a big, great sympathy for my dad, and I think that's what brought me into nursing.
Dad was George Edwards, and your mother was Kathleen Florence Jean Roebuck.
Yes.
And they met up at tennis, you
yes,
say?
Up at Mylor in the hills.
Now, a difficult life, a challenging life, getting up early in the morning, hard physical work. Tell us a bit about that, please, Del.
Well, all I know is that they had to ride in a buggy and trap about 10 or 12 miles to a station from where Grandpa had his garden, market garden, and he and his brother, who'd had his 21st birthday on the ship coming over, decided to buy this block of land at Milo, and they did very, very well with it. They had two sons, one of them had two sons, and they supplied all the fresh fruit and veg to the market that was then going in.
Your father was obviously a very adventurous man. He was born in the UK in Bath, but as a young man he took to the sea and he jumped ship, I believe.
Yes, that's right, he did. He jumped ship, or he knew that.
Jumped ship in Adelaide?
Yes. He and another fellow, they jumped ship and they got a job on the railway sleepers out in the bush somewhere, doing these laying railway sleepers. And yes, and Dad was happy doing that. He was always laughing, and I've got one or two photos of him, you know, of those, if you're interested.
Certainly. Now, your parents were married 17th of September 1921, and your father was working for the railways. They built a house in Murray Bridge, they settled. All should have gone well, he'd survived the war. But then there was a terrible accident.
Well, what happened was, of course, jobs were hard to get, and he took a job as a... they were still taking just spare jobs then. He was working, yes, that's right, joining the trucks and things together like they did.
But something went wrong. What happened?
Well, it had been a dewy morning, and Dad was at the back of the train, holding on to the rail and leaning out with a flag to the... because just near Murray Bridge Station there's a curve, and he was moving right out to move this flag to this driver, Mr. Huddleston, so he could see what he was doing, and his hand slipped and he fell back, and as he fell back he instinctively saved his good leg. His bad leg. He was so used to, you know, looking after that. So he left his good leg underneath the train to be cut off. And Mr. Huddleston, the train driver, who was also a first aid man, he performed first aid and stopped the bleeding and got him up to Dr. Wickens. And Dr. Wickens couldn't do anything for him, so they sent him down to the Adelaide Hospital, and he was in what was called theatre ward in the Adelaide Hospital then for 6 months. Before he was able to, you know, go out and get a new leg.
So his leg was amputated? Was it cut off by the train?
Yeah, that was cut off by the track. But it was, you know, it was sort of finished. It was tidied up.
You're tapping your right leg there. It was his right leg that he lost, was it?
I think it was. And Pat and I, my sister, have great memories. He used to love we kids, and when we were about five, he'd sit us in this big chair next to the wireless, and as it was playing music, he'd bounce us up and down, and all I could feel was this bony end, and I was very conscious and self-conscious. I couldn't tell him or anything like that. You know. I was very, very fond of my father. He adored us, and we used to sit, we lived in the country, and we used to, every night of our life, Pat and I used to sit at the top of the dining room table and look out the window, and there was an old dirt road. He used to come up, swing his kit bag, and limp with his what's his name, and we'd, as soon as we saw him coming, we'd run like mad down the hill to meet him, because he meant so much to us, my father.
He did at least have the assurance of a full-time job and a continuing job in a time of high unemployment.
Yes, well, he did, and I think they did that because of the unfortunate, well, of the way that, because he'd been in the war, and they were trying, I suppose, to do the right thing for the boys that came back,
Talk me through some of those times for you, though. Living as a child in Murray Bridge, going to school. How did you entertain yourself? What was life like?
Well, it was very simple, really. Recess time consisted of skipping across gutters all the time and counting and see who could do the most. Skipping across gutters. The other one, what else did we do? Oh, we used to go over to the funny pommy lady that sold the sweets, and we'd have a halfpenny left over. She said, "Have you got a halfpenny? A halfpenny? Here's the halfpenny tray." And it's funny how things like that, you remember.
You've talked about, it seems incredible these days, it's quite so different. The way you used to wash the clothes, putting them through the wringer and scrubbing.
Oh, yes. Well, of course, we had a washing board, didn't we? And everything got scrubbed. Everything got scrubbed on this glass, undulating glass washing board. And that's what we did to wash the clothes. And then we put them through blue water. We had a knob of Reckitt's blue, and we swung that round the water and made it a nice, till it was a nice colour blue. And then we put all the things through the wringer with the blue.
But it wasn't all just hard work, because I've had the great pleasure of reading some of your memoirs. And when you were only 12 years old, Delphi, Del, I know you don't like your name, but I have to use it, only 12 years old, a young man called Keith Nichols was rather keen on you. Now, what happened at Sturt Reserve that day when you were 12?
Oh, good God, have I put that in? Yeah, well, we went to school and everybody was starting to get boyfriend mad, and I always felt that I was too heavy and ugly to sort of have a... I thought, well, I'll never get anyone. Anyway, this Keith Nichols, we were down swimming at the... because I was a good swimmer. I used to swim across the Murray two or three times. And I swam across, and I think I did it to impress him, And when I came back, he gave me a great big kiss all round the neck. And I remember rebuffing him. Oh, my, shame on me, because he had a brown a birthmark, and it was the size of a great big bit broad bean or something.
Where was it?
Oh, down at the Murray Bridge.
No, where was his birthmark?
Oh, on his neck.
Yeah. But he kissed your neck.
Yeah, we had a kiss on his neck.
He'll give you a couple of hickeys.
Oh, that's terrible. Take that part out.
But I understand it frightened you, because when you got home...
Oh, yeah. Oh, how could I have written all that?
I'm glad you did.
Oh, my God.
But what happened when you got home?
When I got home, Pat was in bed. She's 15 months younger. And I came in all glowing, I said, "I've just kissed Keith Nichols." So I said, and I looked in front of the mirror and I said, "I hope I'm not pregnant." Oh, my neighbour was Don Dunstan. Oh, yeah, that bugger. We were coming home from school one day because his aunties lived there, and he often used to go and live with his aunties.
Now, this is the former Premier of South Australia, Don Dunstan. He lived next, or he visited...
Two doors from us. He lived two doors in Beattie Terrace. And he stayed with his aunties. They were related to her, to their father. And he was a very, very enterprising young man. He used to chase the girls all over the place.
My understanding is that you'd moved up to take...
West Croydon.
To West Croydon or Woodville, is that right?
Yeah, West Croydon. I went to Woodville High. And I finished Woodville High and intermediate. Yeah.
So. Now, you had one particular subject you liked very much, and that was French. Why did you like French so much?
Well, of course, because of my French grandma. I was besotted with it. Absolutely besotted with it. And when it came time to asking for volunteers to join the Free French, you can imagine I was that's the most heartbreaking thing I've had in my whole life, that I never was able to join them.
Well, we'll come to that patriotism and that disappointment in a moment, but you took French and you got honours for your French
at
school.
I always got honours.
And your grandmother was Zélie Vincent.
Zélie
Vincent.
Zélie Vincent.
From
Ers-sur-le-Lys.
And yeah, you were very proud of that connection.
Oh, terribly, yeah. And Pat never took much notice of it, my sister. She didn't even like French. She was more like Mum. She was more sort of on the English side, whereas I was more like my father, and he'd spent such a lot of time in France.
Well, let's get to those days. So born in 1924, December 24, and of course when you left school, war was breaking out, September...
Yes, it was that year, in September 1939. And, yes, that was bad. Well, of course, all our boys were starting to join up, and they didn't even have jobs, you know. It was amazing, really. Some of them they'd ring me up and say goodbye, and I'd say, no, don't go get... Stupidly, I'd say, don't go getting yourself killed. They'd say, I'll try not. First one that I heard of was shot down over Stuttgart. So I did, you know, I did some silly things as well. Made some silly, not accusations, but statements.
Such as, what do you mean?
Well, by saying, don't go getting yourself killed, you know.
But you got a job, and I understand it was a job in an office, an accountant's office.
Yes.
What did you have to do there?
Well, I was. We used to go around with the auditors, and I used to have to add up all the things that they audited them. But I did all the work. That was with Wells Carroll Watson and Co.
Thank you. But burning inside you was this patriotism.
Yes.
So you had this great ambition to do what?
Well, I was going to be with the Free French, and just at that time they were very popular. There was a big advert in the paper, in the Advertiser, and it said, this is an advertisement for people to join the Free French movement. Here are the, whatever you call it.
Recruiting places, yeah.
Yeah. And one was, had to speak French, had to be able to pass a test, with Professor Cornell. Professor Cornell was a French master, and you had to have your parents' permission if you're under 21, and you had to have a French mother, father, or grandfather, or something like that. So I thought, well, what a wonderful opportunity, I can get into the war after all. And I was only just 18, and so I joined. I mean, I applied, and I was turned down because my mother refused to.
So you passed in terms of your command of the French language.
With Professor Cornell.
You had business skills, you'd been examined by Professor Cornell,
yeah.
You had the right qualifications in terms of your ancestry.
Yeah.
But your mother wouldn't sign the release papers.
No, she was just frightened, I suppose, you know, looking back now. And she didn't have good health anyway.
What did she want to do? Did she want to go and fight? And, well, what did you see yourself as doing?
I told you what I wanted to do was I wanted to go, no, I didn't want to go and fight. I wanted to go and sneak in on people, sneak on people. I was a bit of a naughty girl like that. I used to do things that other people wouldn't do, they'd think were unethical. But I was the one that was always the one that would, you know, take on a job. That,
so you saw yourself as an agent or a spy? Or?
I did indeed, and I wasn't a bit frightened. I wanted to be, and I didn't care. I was happy to die for France.
Yeah. But instead, you left your office job and you joined the Australian Army Medical Women's Services, the AAMWS. Yeah. Now, that was a famous organisation.
Yeah.
What was actually the reason for its creation?
Because there were so many nurses going overseas, trained nurses, and not only... they were going to more and more and more places. I don't know that there were that many killed, but they were going to more and more places, and they were very, very short. And so I decided that I'd like to do that, you know. And now, did I have to have my... Yes, I think I was under 23. You had to be 23. I had to be 23, I remember. And Mum wouldn't sign the papers.
Nevertheless, you enlisted at the age of 19.
Yes, so I joined the lesser thing that I could, and that was just as an ordinary hand, you'd say.
An orderly, something of that nature?
Yes, an orderly. And I went to an orderly school at Darley in Victoria.
Yes.
And I made wonderful lifelong friendships there. Lifelong, from 19 till retiring time. I had a wonderful training. We had route marches. It was real, real tough army stuff. And I managed it beautifully. Went route marches for days and slept out at Darley.
Yes.
Near Bacchus Marsh, and my friend Leela came with me, and I met lots of people that...
So you were 18, going on 19, you'd left your office job, you'd enrolled, enlisted in the Australian Army Medical Women's Services, you'd taken this training as an orderly.
Pretty colourful life, didn't I? Yeah. And then when I was... the powers that be decided that everybody that had done this course now had to go back to where they were initiated from, like Victoria, they were VX or they were QX, Queensland or SX. And so that's when I told my big lie.
You told a big whopping lie. What was that lie you told?
And I said that my mother and father had got a transfer. I had a marvellous imagination, and I said they'd got a transfer and they were going to come over to Melbourne, and the colonel swallowed it hook, line and sinker, I thought he did anyway, and he said right, so I went to, and that's how I got into the Victorian part of the...
So you were posted then, as a result of that whopping but very effective lie, you were posted to 115 AGH,
that's
Australian
right.
General Hospital, at Heidelberg.
At
Heidelberg in Victoria.
Yes, that's right. And it was a huge hospital, and that was what really decided that I'd nursing was my career, because I saw some dreadful things there. We had, at that time, convoys. We had convoys of our boys coming back from prisoners of war camps, and it was heartbreaking to see them, those 12 stone blokes, go off and come back as 5 stone.
But before that, though, the Army brought in the Army Nurse Training Scheme.
Oh, yes.
Just 30 trainees, and you were selected for that.
I was.
Now, what did that involve?
Well, that was because they didn't have enough sisters, you see, and they wanted to train more up so that we could, you know, fill their places. And I was one of them that did the Army training course, and we had but don't think it was an easy pushover. We had to have special lecturers, like lieutenant colonels who would be the top surgeons, and different ones had to give up a certain time. The Army made them to lecture us, and they gave us marvellous lectures. And I used to, because I was so keen, I was put in the theatre. And I used to do theatre, theatre work.
By this time, Del was allowed to train for what she called recognition as a proper sister. She nursed desperately unwell prisoners of war and came into contact with a distinguished nursing officer, Sister Vivian Bullwinkle, sole survivor of the Banker Island massacre.
She was sent to Heidelberg. Just as a launching pad to sort of, you know, just try and recover a bit. And I was in charge of that ward 14, 15, where she was. And first she was a little bit hesitant because she was very, very determined not to say too much before she got in front of this commission. But she did tell me about the truth about how the Japanese had come back wiping their swords, you know, and Matron Drummond saying, "Come on, girls, heads up, 1, 2, 3," and that's what Matron Drummond did and got them out into the water.
What did you learn from this close association with Vivian Bullwinkle? What did that teach you?
Well, just that I admired her tremendously. I envied her because that's exactly what I'd wanted to do all through the war, be somebody.
Fully qualified now, she went to the UK and through an agency found a series of appointments nursing private patients before further travel through Europe. On the voyage home, she met a young man, Ian Graham, who was working as a ship's steward. A courtship by correspondence followed, and they married in England in 1953. Australia's Army nurses received national recognition in 1999 with the dedication of a memorial on Anzac Parade in Canberra. Del Graham was there for the unveiling, as was her friend and hero figure, Vivian Bullwinkle.